So, put the review sessions in your calendar in pencil, and I'll let you know if they change. No questions, huh? Okay. Did you figure out how to roll over? And how you learned to crawl? Probably. Okay. I want to make that point again. I will make it again and again and again and again. So, what I would like you to be doing is to make sure that you understand the sequence and that you have it ingrained in your mind indelibly so you'll never lose it. The sequence from undifferentiated to differentiated to integrated. And that you are watching for examples of that sequence. And there are dozens of examples whenever you look at anything that is developing in any of the domains, it's likely that you will find that sequence. Yes?
Is there any way you can write in that a little? I think that's probably right at the
bottom. Maybe. Sure, just turn up the iris. That help? A little? Okay. The technology wizard. Okay, that's on the website. It's there. And when you are developing motor skills, I will repeat. When you're developing motor skills, you are differentiating the various parts of the body, gaining control over each, and then putting them together. And what the infant and toddler are working on particularly are the differentiation of the parts. And then as they get control over each part and can move it at will in different directions, then they can combine those parts into more skilled and more complex movements. And that's a process that takes us from gaining control over our grasp or moving our arm in a direction that we would like to move it right on up through the most skilled athletic performance that you could imagine. How many of you are dancers? You started off probably in third grade or when you were 3 or 4 or 5. Remember you did the positions? 1, 2, 3. I've forgotten 4. That's as far as I got in dance. And then you learn to move one arm and you learn to move the other arm and you learn to move them this way and then you learn to go this way. All of those exercises that are part of traditional dance are learning to isolate or differentiate each part of the body, attend to it, and construct a movement, and then a repertoire of movements for that particular part of your body. And then as you develop all of those different ones, you can combine them in an infinite number of combinations and become a professional dancer. If you fail to go through puberty, if you're willing to starve yourself to delay puberty, if you have the right genes and all of the other things that are associated with becoming a classical dancer, if you become a modern dancer, you can go ahead and go through puberty and have hips and breasts and it's okay. You just have to remain flexible. And modern dance includes typically each choreographer developing a different language, a different set of movements and combinations of them which become sort of a signature for a particular choreographer. And if you watch modern dance particularly, you watch people do things with their body that you think they couldn't possibly do. Many of them strike me as being very similar to being able to pat your head and, you know, what am I, pat my head and I can't even put it into words, rub my tummy at the same time that I'm skipping, chewing gum and blowing bubbles and all of those sorts of things, and they're just amazing. A good soccer player also impresses me in the same way, and a tight end receiver on a football team, a good field hockey, you know, all of those athletic performances that we extend from the basics of rolling over and crawling and walking. They're just simply an extension, new constructions and new possible ways of the infinite variety of ways that your body can move if you practice it, if you separate the movements, if you put them together, integrate them in a coordinated fashion. When we look at motor skills, what we see is the effect of practice. I cited Thalen, I'm going to do that again, that the infant and the environment form an interconnected system, and it's a continuous process of interaction, I would say transaction, between the baby and the environment, and then as you develop, between the toddler and the environment, the young child and the environment, the adolescent and the environment. We're constantly adapting to the environment, putting together the body as it matures, the possibilities in the environment, the motivation that we develop and that is encouraged by adults, and we use the particular opportunities as we do that. Let me give you an example that is not included in the book. This is some very classic research. I'm going to show you first a picture. I'm going to get as close as I can on this picture. I am trying to find a better one, Talia, of the same scene. Okay, you can make it out, I think, up there, not very well, but let me help. Okay, this is from the laboratory of a woman named Myrtle McGraw, who died in her, I think she was about 90 or 91 a few years ago. What Myrtle McGraw did was take half of pairs of twins. She just randomly, so she got volunteers, nice middle-class people who lived near the university where she worked. And she got the twins. They were all healthy. They were all roughly the same size. And they were, because they were twins, they were the same age. And she would instruct the parents to do nothing particularly special for one of the twins. That was her control group. And then she invited the infants into her lab, one of each pair of twins, and they would come in once or twice a week, and they would just hang out, as babies will do, in her lab, which was an interesting place because it was a large space. Part of it was carpeted, and she would put things in the space, things like balance beams, like stairs, like ramps, and just allow the kids to explore the environment that she had created, which was just simply an attractive space with things in it. Things that were safe and things that provided opportunities for infants and then toddlers and later young children to practice motor skills. So you have a ramp. How often do you get to go up a ramp? Some of us as children learn to climb up the slide from the bottom, but that's fairly sophisticated because slides are slick and they're steep and it's hard to get up on them. What she did was provide ramps that kids could climb up. balance beams. As the kids got older, the balance beams got longer and narrower and higher. This particular illustration, I'm sorry, it's not real clear. This is a bookcase sort of thing. There's another one. There's another one. There's another one. I think there's one, and then what this kid has done, this two-year-old, is climb by herself up the boxes to get an object that's hanging from the ceiling. Two-year-olds don't normally do that, because two-year-olds don't normally have an environment that encourages them from infancy to go up steps and to climb up steps that get taller and taller. But if you create an environment that has those opportunities, kids will develop the skills to master the environment and to go wherever the environment allows them to go using the skills that they practice. This was all fun. They never forced the child to do anything. They didn't scare kids. They didn't beg them to go up. They didn't say, I won't love you if you don't climb this. They just simply put them up there. Here they are. Okay? Do what you want to do. And what they discovered, what Myrtle discovered, was that kids have incredible skills that we don't usually see until much later, if you just simply give them the opportunity to practice and the motivation. So they were an hour a day. It got extended as the kids got older because they would scream when their parents would come to take them. And you know, when kids don't want to leave a place, that they're typically having fun. And the parents, as the kids got older, would say, you know, she's ready an hour before. She's standing by the door saying, go play, go play. This particular kid is up there, about 8 feet, reaching. There is no railing anywhere. This kid just simply went up, and this was a usual kind of performance. For those of you who are worried about child safety, that is a skirt. There is a graduate student standing on the other side, ready to catch the kid if the kid falls. Again. If it falls backwards, she better move quickly. The photographer had better move quickly. Somebody had better get there. Myrtle demonstrated that when you provide the opportunities, kids will be motivated to master the environment. That seems to be built in. They want to move. They want to be able to climb things. They want to be able to do balance beams, especially if they see other kids doing them. And they will work very hard to master those skills. And then she said a very important thing. They don't turn out different from other kids, except in the area where you have encouraged or permitted them to develop skills. In any activity that includes those skills, they will be ahead of other kids. So if you're comparing them to age mates, in this case they're twins who didn't have the opportunity, these kids will be much more skilled than their twins. And she demonstrated that for these kids who had this experience, they were 3, 4, and 5 as years old as they went up through it, that they retained superiority in their physical skills. Balance, grace, fluidity of their movements, the ability to integrate their movements into new skills. They retained that well into adulthood. The last time I saw her, she was lecturing about this, and she had her home movie of one pair of twins. She got them in their late 20s to come to her house, stripped down to their underwear, these two wonderful young men, stripped down to their shorts, and do a balance beam, climb a ladder that was up against the side of her house. And the difference between them is very, very clear. The one who had the enrichment skips along the balance beam. This is 23 years later. He skips along the balance beam. He goes up the ladder gracefully, sort of hanging on a little bit. The other one does the Larry thing up the ladder. Okay, let's go up. You know, I'm kind of clumsy at it. Hang on tight because I don't want to fall off this thing. And what she was demonstrating was that the early experience, not followed up in any way. The kids stopped coming when they were five. She never did anything more with them. 23 years later, you still see an amazing difference between the twins. And she did this with several sets, and in every case, the twin who had had this experience in early childhood was much more graceful and skilled physically. What she suggests is that it didn't make them super, it didn't make them gifted. What it did was allow them to develop skill early on, which then made them, as they went into new environments, able to master those new environments with new physical skills more easily than other kids did. And that in itself was motivating. So you've got the kid who's got good balance and comfort with physical activity, and perhaps has, as some of her kids did, gone roller skating at two, because she made that possibility available to them. You've got this kid who comes into playing soccer or baseball or other skills with a facility that allows him to more quickly differentiate the movements that are required in any particular activity and then integrate them more successfully, and compared to age mates, to succeed. And Myrtle's argument was that you can do that for any kid. You don't have to have special genes. You can simply provide an experience that brings out what is potentially there for all of us, as long as the kid was intact and all of the kids that she had were healthy and normal kids. I thought I saw a hand with a question. No. Okay. Let me give you a more specific example. I'll unzoom it so you can actually see what it is. Okay. You want to guess how many of you water ski? How old were you when you learned? Any of you just a day shy of 8 months? This kid is 7 months and 29 days old. He's Parks Bonifay. Okay. His parents worked in the water show in Florida. He was in the water from the time he was born. He was probably born underwater. And what they have done is put him in the water and then put him on skis. And at 8 months, they are taking advantage of the tendency of kids to be working on extensor tone. So this kid is putting his legs down straight, and then they're pulling him. And this is just a still photo. I've seen a movie of him going round and round the performance area. And he was able to do that because he had the opportunity. There's nothing particularly special about the skill, except that he's had the opportunity to develop it because his parents have put him happily in that environment. Now, take the point that gives him some advantage in the water skiing world. And after I'd been using this picture for several years, I picked up a Time magazine and there's this kid who is in Time magazine because he has just become the world wakeboarding champion. He's 15. It's good old Parks. Okay. And if you go on his website, just Google him, you can go on his website, you can buy videos of Parks Bonifay, who is now a professional wakeboarder. I don't know if he can read and write. I don't know if he has any social skills at all. But he does demonstrate McGraw's point that when you develop a skill earlier than other people do, you have an advantage. And you simply construct more and more refined and sophisticated repertoire of activities based on that early experience. And that's what Parks Bonifay has done. That was 1997. He turned pro a number of years ago, and the photos and videos on his website are lots of fun. I'm not going to take class time to do that, to show you those. Okay, so what's happening? Well, one of the things that's happening is that as you are practicing, you're taking advantage of the opportunities that your environment provides, and as you practice, you're creating cell assemblies in your brain that reflect that experience. Everything that you know is reflected in your brain structure, in the way the cells talk to each other. And so what you see as kids are learning any kind of action, okay, is that the action that they're learning is based on the structure of the body and the experience that is available to them. In McGraw's case, she was giving them the opportunity to have to move in ways that allowed them to refine the actions. Okay. So they practice those. As you learn and perfect the particular action, you create brain connections that go along with that action. As you create those brain connections, you create the foundation for a better action. So what you're doing when you practice and when you extend and push yourself to do something new is you're taking advantage of the brain connections, and then you're creating more brain connections, and as you create more brain connections, you're creating the possibility of more developed actions. So you have this transaction going on between the developing brain and the motor activity. Way back in the really dark old ages of developmental psychology, back when I was a graduate student, the assumption was that kids will learn to do things as the brain matures, and that the brain is maturing on its own timetable. So there's no point pushing kids or providing enriched experience, particularly in motor skills, because they'll get it and you can't push them. What McGraw pointed out for us and convinced us of, and what Parks Bonifay and all of our actual experience when we go beyond the research, what all of that points out is that the brain, in fact, is developing not on its own. It's developing in response to experience, as long as that experience is within the potential for the body at that particular point. So there's a transaction going on between the activity, the stimulation and the experience, and the brain. And if the brain isn't ready to develop, it's not going to use that experience. But if it's ready, it will use that experience to create more brain development. And as the brain develops, then new things become potential. Now we see this most clearly in motor development, because that's the one we've studied most often and most thoroughly. But keep in mind the possibility that this is also happening in language, which is, with speech is a motor skill, but language itself is a cognitive skill. Maybe it happens in social relationships. It probably happens in any of the areas where we see kids changing. As they experience, they push their brains, and the brain responds to the experience by creating connections. As it creates connections, it makes more sophisticated experience possible. And if the kid has the opportunity to do that sophisticated experience, then that leads to more brain connections, and that's a dynamic system. So a new skill leads to new opportunities, which leads to new skills and more opportunities, and that's a dynamic system. When Thalen talks about motor development as a dynamic system, that's what she means. That the body is growing and developing, but it is responding to the practice. And the environment is providing opportunities. Or not. Or not. It's important that sometimes the environment doesn't allow us to engage in experience, so we don't make those connections. And if later we get into a situation where we're expected or need the particular skill that we've never practiced, we're up the creek because we don't have it. And that make it very difficult for us to adapt to the demands of a new situation. Okay. That's on the website in some form. Let me say just a couple of things about the brain more specifically, because the brain is a really important part of physical development. One of the things we know is that different parts of the brain are connected to different parts of the rest of the body, and activity in a particular part of the brain is connected to activity in that part of the body. So as you're practicing your motor skills, you're probably developing connections in the motor cortex. As you're practicing seeing things and eventually reading, you're going to be using the visual cortex. So different parts of the brain are connected to different parts of the sensory system, and the parts of the brain develop and mature at different times. There's a sequence. So what we see in development as behavior changes, we're seeing the maturation of the brain in particular areas. And the brain is not finished with maturation. That is the biological change, not just connections, but the biological change. It's not finished until about your age, 20, 21, 23, before your brain actually has created all of the structures that it needs and matured all of the basic nerve systems, all of the assemblies. So that's a long process. And as that process happens, it's responding to the specific experience, so that's accelerating brain development, but only within limits. And as it happens, we're seeing changes in the behavior. How does the brain change? Several different ways. The quick summary of brain development. The brain starts with cell genesis during the embryonic period. And so long before you're born, your brain starts to be created by having cells divide. And so cells are dividing very, very quickly. I think Lithgow said in the video something like 25,000 a second or a minute, whatever it was. Huge number of cell divisions. And as the cells are dividing, there are actually two kinds of parts of the brain. One part, the cells are generated and they just simply accumulate in a particular area. And in other parts of the brain, particularly the cortex, the outer part, the cells actually are generated low down in the brain, in the old part of the brain. The cells are generated in particular areas of that old part of the brain, which is the first part to develop. And what the brain is going to do is build a cortex, but it doesn't create cells out there. It creates the cells here. And it starts, as you're developing, it starts by putting down one kind of cell called a glial cell, which is essentially a railroad track for the neurons, which are going to be created here. And the glial cells are going to grow out, and then the neurons, as they're generated, are going to migrate along those glial pathways to get to where they need to be to form a cortex. So you have proliferation or genesis of the cells, and then you have migration, not in every part of the brain, but in significant parts of the brain, like the cortex. And that migration is important, and it can be disrupted. Two examples of disruption of migration. It's a very important process. One is exemplified by the babies that were born after the United States dropped atomic bombs on two cities in Japan. Lots of people got killed, but there were a number of pregnant women who didn't get killed, and they survived, but they were exposed to large doses of radiation. And radiation is not good for most living things, and it's not particularly good for embryos and fetuses, and many women miscarried because their embryos were destroyed by the radiation, couldn't survive. Others delivered babies that had a whole variety of problems. I'm not going to go into that whole litany. But there's one particular group of babies who, it turns out, were at the same state of development when the bombs were dropped. And they were at a stage in development when migration was happening. And migration was pretty much at its peak. And those now adults, we're 60 years later, they are 60 years old, and they are a very distinctive group of people, generally happy, generally healthy, generally not very bright. They can do repetitive tasks. They're pretty good at sorting nails and stuff like that, and they have special homes for and factories for this group of people, and Japan is committed to maintaining them in a healthy state. But they all have the same problem in their brains. And the problem is that because of the radiation, migration stopped. So the cells were being developed and they were trying to migrate, and then migration stopped. The cells just didn't go any farther. So these people have empty space where you would expect to have nerve cells forming a cortex. And if you had already created the cortex, the migration process was fairly far along, and you were an older fetus, your brain is fine. If you were younger, you probably didn't survive at all. So radiation can interfere with that migration process. Another example comes from fetal alcohol syndrome. The text describes it a little bit, but what it means is that the mother ingested large amounts of alcohol, typically on a daily basis, and we're talking a lot of alcohol, a bottle of wine a day. And kids whose mothers did that get born with problems in attention, problems in some kinds of reasoning, problems in behavior control, self-management, self-regulation. If you have an opportunity to look at their brains, what you discover is that alcohol does to the baby's brain in utero the same thing it does to many of you, or will when you get to be 21 and start to drink. It will do the same thing to you. Remember, it dissolves your inhibitions and you go ahead and do things that are kind of stupid. You've watched people do this. What happens is that alcohol interferes with the migration process, not by stopping it as the radiation does, but by not stopping it. The cells don't know when to quit, so they just keep migrating. And they cluster and clump at the top of the brain, leaving sometimes empty portions in the middle, because instead of stopping there and spreading out, the cells just kept on going. They couldn't stop themselves. They just did it, right, because of the alcohol. And sometimes actually growing through the brain membrane and having clusters of cells that are not organized. They're just disorganized clusters of nerve cells on the outside of the membrane. You can't create coordinated connections when the nerve cells are disorganized. And alcohol causes them to be disorganized by interfering with their regulation as they're migrating. So they go too far, just like your roommate who drinks too much. And they go too far. They don't know when to quit. They get disorganized. They become incompetent. So if you want to know why the doctor says don't drink if you think you might be pregnant, that's why. You're interfering with brain development. Okay, that's migration. The brain also develops by increasing the size of cells. They keep on growing. Okay? And that's a process that starts with very, very small cells as they're developed, and then the cell body itself grows in size. So brain cells become bigger. Brain cells grow in connection. Okay? As you develop, your brain creates connections. As you learn, your brain grows connections. And the text describes all this. This is not new stuff. The brain cells connect to each other, touch each other, so they can pass messages back and forth. And I'm going to skip from 4 to 7. What happens with the connections as you use them is that you consolidate them into cell assemblies. So you have groups of cells that are connected richly to each other, and those represent or are the basis for your knowledge, your abilities, the skills, the motions that you can make, the faces that you recognize. Every piece of information that you have that you can use is represented by an assembly of cells, a circuit or a pathway. Going back to 5, the brain also develops by losing cells. The brain just creates all these cells, but it creates far more than you need. So as the cells grow, those that are not used, not involved in anything that you're engaged in, die off. And there are special messages, genetic messages, that are incorporated in cells that say, if you haven't been used for the last whatever period of time, die. We need your space. We need to get rid of you to make space for other connections. You're just in the way. So, and that's called apoptosis, or cell pruning, cell death. The brain also matures by creating connections, more connections that it needs, more synapses, And then those wither if they're not used. So you have synaptic pruning. And then finally, the brain matures by myelinizing the nerve pathways. And that's the area, that's the one that continues to go on right on up through the mid-20s. Color adjust. This is from the text, or one version of it. So what you have is a neuron, a nerve cell. It puts out the axons and dendrites. They connect to each other, creating synapses or connections, and then you get a whole bunch of these, creating a cell assembly. The hot dog structure is the myelin. It looks like a string of sausages, right? And just like sausages that are full of fat, myelin is a cholesterol-based fatty substance that forms an insulation along the nerve cells, and it increases the efficiency and the speed of connection from cell to cell. So what you see is that this is the slowest part to develop. You have all those brain cells early on, and you have all those connections being developed, and then as you use your brain, you're creating the connections and the cell assemblies. But the myelin sheath around the nerve cells is developing at different rates at different parts of the brain at different times. And what we see then is that the parts that you need early on, the lower parts of the brain, are myelinized very early on, some of them prenatally. And then as you develop, as you're developing new skills, you're representing, you're using the parts of the brain that are becoming myelinized at that point. And it's become very popular now to point out that the last part of the brain to be fully myelinized is the part that lets you understand the potential consequences of your behavior and to plan and to think about the future in a useful way. So that you can say, by the time you're 21 or 22 or 24, oh, let's see, the semester has 14 weeks, I have 5 courses, this is the information that I need to try to absorb, and these are all the things I have to get done. Let me plan a schedule, and let me understand that if I skip all my classes for 2 weeks and don't study, I'm not going to be able to skip to that schedule, and then I'm not going to get into medical school or whatever your goal is. That part of the brain doesn't see much myelination until the early teens, and the last parts of it are not myelinized fully until the early to mid-20s. I think I don't have an overhead that I wanted. Oh, I know. It's not in an overhead. It's in my notes. I wanted to say one more thing about brain development. But I may not have that either. Who messed up my notes? Okay. The point I'm going to make is that all of the illustrations in the text and everywhere else suggest that a nerve cell has, 8 or 10 of those projections out to other nerve cells. In fact, a nerve cell will have 50,000 of them. The nerve cells are very large. They're very big. And they have thousands of connections to other nerve cells. And if you do the math, which is what I have in my notes, I'll bring it Monday, if you remind me, Talia, that if you do the math, what you see is that there are trillions of connections in the brain. It's such a big number, you can't even think about it. The brain is made up of billions of cells with trillions of connections, an infinite variety of ways that the cells can be connected to each other. And the actual photographs, when you can get one, and I haven't found a good one, if you see a good one of all that rich mass of stuff in the brain, it looks very different than this schematic, which says, okay, I got all these connections. Multiply those connections by several thousand, and you'll have what's really happening. in the brain. Now, as the brain matures, some significant periods of brain development occur, and they're ones when we see a big shift in how the brain is able to put information together as connections are built. And one of those we see sometime in the middle of the second year. And that's a fun one. I love watching 15 to 20 month old kids, because a big change that's happening in their brain is that they're figuring out which side is dominant. So they're becoming left or right-handed. And the majority of us are right-handed, and the creative ones are left-handed, and the ones with reading problems don't know which hand we have because we're ambidextrous and we get confused. But most of us have two essentially symmetrical parts of the brain, and it's a neat fail-safe system, because in infancy, if you take out half of the cortex, it's not going to have much effect on the person's development or life later. There'll be a few very subtle, sophisticated kinds of problems, particularly in spatial relationships, that kid may or the adult may not be able to do. But if you have a massive malfunction on just one side of the brain, like uncontrollable epileptic seizures that mean that the whole brain has been malformed on that side, you can just take that side out, stop the seizures, and the person will continue to develop. Most of us don't have that problem. What we have is the necessity to decide which side of the brain is going to be dominant. And that happens during the middle part of the year, the second year. It means, for example, for the right-handed of us, the left side of the brain is going to be dominant. And that's going to control the right side of the body, so we're going to be right-handed. If we're fully left dominant and right-handed, we'll also kick with our right foot. We'll sight a bow and arrow or a gun with our right eye. We'll use that side of the brain more than we'll use the other side. And we'll differentiate what happens on each side of our brain. For example, you watch as we become, for example, right-handed, you watch a kid coming up into about second birthday, the kid's getting right-handed, you'll see that small motor activities that require fine control will be focused in the right hand. The power will be focused, the large motor that doesn't require any coordination will be focused in the left hand. What that means is if you have to hold something still to poke at it or to take it apart, you'll hold on to it with your left hand, and you'll develop power in your left hand and fine motor control in your right. So you're differentiating the skills of the two sides of your body. That's the result of lateralization. About the time that happens, you're figuring out grammar. So you're beginning to use two words together using rules. That's a cognitive skill, but it depends on having one part of the brain develop, two parts of the brain, one for understanding language and the other for producing it. They're close to each other. And if you don't decide that one side of the brain is going to be lateralized, you may have difficulty processing language, which is why we worry when kids can't figure out whether they're left-handed or right-handed, or they have mixed dominance, because that is a predictor. It's not a perfect predictor, but it's a risk for having reading problems. As you become lateralized, you also figure out running. Okay? So you can control both sides of your body in a way that allows you to be off the ground part of the time and catch yourself on alternate feet. That's what running is. You have to leave the ground or you're not running. So when a kid starts to run, he's literally falling but catching himself with the other foot. And that requires lateralization, and it requires communication between the two sides of the brain. Okay, so that's one big shift, middle of the second year. The next one that is significant for us happens during the period from 5 to 7, and that's a period during which the brain creates many more connections between the major structures, and particularly connections that allow us to integrate or put together information that comes in through different sensory systems. So the 5 to 7 shift allows the kid to put together what he's seeing with what she's hearing, with what he's doing motorically at the same time. And that's necessary for reading and writing. It's necessary for being able to follow a series of instructions. You've got to coordinate it with memory, so that if the teacher tells you to pick up the pencil, go close the door, place the book on the table, that's an item from the Stanford Binet Intelligence Test, some version of that. You have to keep in memory these three things that you've been told to do, and then you have to be able to do them in the order in which you've been told. So you have to hear them, process that, and then go through the motor steps in the appropriate sequence. And all of that is a reflection that you've created connections that are useful between those different parts of the brain. So being able to take dictation, being able to follow directions, being able to be a little bit conscious of your motor skill so you can inhibit, which allows you to take coaching. It's very difficult to get a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old to pay attention to you and to deliberately change motor activity. This is what coaching is. You want them to change it in a specific way. They can't do that using just the language. If you're going to coach 3-year-olds or 4-year-olds, you have to actually go through the motion with them. Okay. The words don't make any difference. You can go through the motion, and then you can talk to them at the same time, and maybe they'll get the idea. But when kid goes through to 7 or 8 years old, you can talk to them about what they're doing, and they can actually process that and say, oh, okay, raise my right shoulder. I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. Okay, raise my right shoulder higher when I bat, rather than putting it down here. It's going to change the way I swing the bat, right? And it's going to change the way I perform with the bat, the way I hit. Okay, so you're integrating various parts of the brain, and that makes traditional school possible. Okay? So you can go into a group, you can be instructed verbally, you can pay attention, you can inhibit your behavior enough that there's not a riot going on. And we start all kinds of new activities for kids as they become able to put together and hang on to information from different sources. Okay. Now that leads us into middle childhood. We're now out of early childhood. It moves us into middle childhood. And that's a fun period of time. Growth is fairly steady. It's moderate. You've slowed down. Growth slows down. You know when you're growing fastest in your life? What year did you grow the most? Eh? More than that. Somebody set it up here. From when you were born to when you were 5? What's faster than that? Raise a hand and tell me loudly. One person. Who really knows? What? No, puberty's... When you're a fetus, the first 9 months, 21 inches. In 9 months, you're never going to do that again. Okay? Growth goes like this. And it hits a plateau. You're still growing. Okay. This is how much you're growing in height, increase, and this is age. Then you get born, and so that's zero. In our culture, in other cultures, it's one. It's really 3/4, but we can't deal with that. This is 5 to 7. Slows down, plateaus, and then somebody said puberty, right? That's the pubertal growth spurt. But it's nothing like that. Okay? So this is middle childhood, 5 to 7 to puberty. And growth is steady. You have a chance to really coordinate your body physically. You can work on the skills. You're not having to deal with breasts, hips, all that other stuff that happens that throws you off balance and out of proportion. And you're not growing so quickly as you do as a child, so that you're constantly adapting to a changing body. So you can work on skilled performances. And then comes puberty. And puberty, we all remember. Puberty, okay, means we develop zits, hair in places we don't want it, hair in places we do want it. Okay. And all of those changes of puberty are because the endocrine system goes through a huge convulsion that is designed to take this growing, happy, middle child who is not yet reproductively mature and turn him or her into a reproductive adult. So puberty is a set of physiological changes that render the immature organism capable of reproduction. That's what it's about. Now, we're going to talk about puberty. It involves two major structures in the brain, part of the endocrine system, the hypothalamus and the pituitary, and they're close together. It involves the thyroid, which is a major source of growth hormone. It involves the adrenal cortices, which are little kidney bean-shaped things on top of your kidneys. Yeah. Kidneys aren't really that big, and neither are adrenal cortices. And it involves the gonads, the ovaries, and testicles, testes. Okay? So you remember all of that. And what happens at puberty is that you start to grow more quickly, and you do that because your hormones change, and that happens because the pituitary is responding to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is monitoring all of the systems of the body, metabolic rate, metabolic demand, calorie intake, calorie burning, temperature, all of those sorts of things. And when you reach a particular weight, the hypothalamus says, we need to make this system more efficient. And we're going to do that by making it bigger. And interesting, you think of small things being efficient, but in fact, if you're a shrew, you're very small, you lose a lot of heat, and you have to eat more than your body weight every day just to stay alive. If you're an elephant, you're a heat sink, and you don't lose a lot of heat, and you can't eat your body weight in food every day, but you have to eat a very small proportion compared to the hummingbird or the shrew, which burn energy faster, almost faster than they can replace it. And if they can't replace it, they die very quickly. It takes a long time to starve an elephant to death. So the elephant is more efficient metabolically. What happens is that the hypothalamus says, okay, we've reached a big enough size, so we're going to increase the growth rate. And we do that, if we're a hypothalamus, by kicking the pituitary chemically. And the pituitary says, okay, I'm going to secrete a whole bunch of things that I normally secrete in much higher proportions. Okay, so big quantities. So blood concentrations of a number of hormones increase, and those hormones affect the other endocrine organs, the adrenal cortices, the gonads, and they start secreting their hormones, and that's going to cause the bodily changes that we call puberty. If we look at the beginning of it, we can talk about onset. So there's an age for each of us when we started growing faster. This is pubertal onset, the pubertal growth spurt. We can talk about when that happens, and then we can talk about the timing of it. Some of us are very early maturers. So I can be a 7-year-old girl. Well, I can't be, but a 7-year-old girl can. I'm too old to be a 7-year-old girl. A 7-year-old girl might start that growth spurt if she's a big kid and healthy. Another kid might start that at 13 or 14. On average, girls start about 11, 10, still going down. And boys start a year and a half to 2 years later. And we'll look at why that happens. We can look then at timing. If you want to know about when you're going to start, look at your parent of the same sex. That's your best predictor. We can then also look at how quickly it happens. Some girls will go from the beginning of the growth spurt to menarche, first menstruation, which is the end of puberty, in 6 months. Some of you did that, right? Seventh grade, you remember it really well. Breasts started developing, you grew like a weed, and then you went through your first period, and it was 6 months, and it was over. Others of us took 6 years to do the same thing, from breast buds to first menstruation. So the rate is variable, and that's also genetic. The pattern is different. Some of us show what we call androgenic effects first. We develop the hair, and estrogenic effects later. The breasts come later. Others are the reverse. And some people do it synchronously. They go through all the changes at the same time. And the sequence is different for each of the sexes. As we talk about hormones, we're going to talk about three classes of hormones. Androgens, which we typically think of as being male, and they sort of are, except that women produce androgens too. Estrogens, which we think of as being female, but men produce them as well. And gestagens, which men don't produce because they're only produced by the ovaries. Okay. So there are three classes of hormones. And before you leave, I have a handout that you can take with you and familiarize yourself with over the weekend. You can pick up your exercises down here as well. And if you're celebrating the new year this weekend, wait. Talia is going to talk about the writing exercise. Okay. I'm going to give her the microphone. And if you're celebrating the new year this weekend, Happy New Year. Can I put that back up? Sure. It's on the website, too.
Thank you. Okay. I was going to the activity. There's a few things that I noticed.